Good evening, everyone. My name is Sonia. I'm the president of the Economic Society. We're very pleased and honored to have Professor Charlie Bean of the Bank of England speaking for us today. If you could all please turn off your mobile phones and electronic devices, I'm going to pass it over to Professor Pissarides, who's going to introduce Charles Bean. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sonia. I first met Charlie Bean some 25 years ago when he was a young treasury economist visiting MIT for a year. And I was then on a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard, so we spent some time together talking about economics and life in America and Europe. So one day Charlie came to me and said that MIT asked him to stay on to do a PhD with Robert Solow, and should he take it. Now, having failed myself to get a place at MIT a few years earlier to do a PhD with Solow, I said to Charlie, say yes quickly before they change their mind. I think it was a unique opportunity, which of course he immediately did. So the PhD was done in record time, from what I remember. And Charlie came back, and he had to go to the Treasury, but obviously we tried very hard, and we got him, and he came to the LSE. He joined us here, where he spent some maybe 15 years at the LSE. 18 years at the LSE. He had a very good career. He became professor, of course. He became... kind of thing. I sometimes get in student evaluations, not in a public place. anyway, the PhD was done in record time. Charlie came back to join us at the LSE. He had a very good career where he became professor. He became editor of the Review of Economic Studies. And we taught macro principles together at 210, where I did the solo stuff and Charlie did policy. We co-authored some papers together. But Charlie's interests were always in economic policy. And I always thought that in life there are some things that you always know that they should go together. And two of these things are the chief economist position at the Bank of England and Charlie Bean. I always thought sort of Charlie was really cut out for that position. And sure enough, it happened. Now Charlie has been at the Bank of England now for maybe 5 years, six, I always have by 1 year. And of course, he's a member of the Monetary Policy Committee. But, and of course, he was the Bank of England gain, our loss. But we are fortunate enough that Charlie comes back to the LSE to talk to us every now and then. So I'm especially pleased to welcome Charlie Bean to the London School of Economics and to invite him to address the LSE Economic Society and their guests.
Well, good evening. With the lady who just left, I think that was a first for me, because I've had the odd person who's left a lecture in the middle, but I've never had anybody who's leave my lecture before I've even opened my mouth. anyway, if you Google globalization, you'll find it generates around 45 million hits. So quite a lot of virtual ink has already been spilt on my topic tonight. Though I should say it's rather less than had been spilt on Madonna, because if you Google her, you get no less than 90 million hits. Anyway, the term globalization is often used rather loosely, and sometimes it should be said abusively, to describe all sorts of phenomena. But my talk tonight is going to focus on just the impact of globalization on the industrialized economies, and in particular on the inflation process. What do I mean by globalization? Well, it's the changes in economic geography brought about by the integration of China, India, and the emerging economies of Eastern Europe into the world economy, and the increased ease with which production can be relocated around the globe. Of course, the progressive development and integration of more countries into the international trading system isn't a new phenomenon. In the post-war era, we've seen first the rise of Japan, closely followed by the emergence of Korea and the other tiger economies of Southeast Asia. But what is new this time is the sheer scale of events. With the entry of China, India, and Eastern Europe into the global market economy, effectively doubling the world economy's labor supply from roughly 1.5 billion to around 3 billion. Now, most of these extra workers are relatively unskilled and brought little capital with them into the world economy. So the effect has been to lower the ratios of skilled labor and physical capital to unskilled labor. This should then drive down the wages of unskilled labor relative to skilled labor, as well as driving up the rate of profit on capital. And we should expect to see the production of goods and services that are intensive in the use of unskilled labor shifting to these emerging economies, with production in the industrialized economies shifting towards goods and services that are more intensive in the use of skilled labor. Let's call them knowledge-based industries. And that's indeed pretty much what's been happening. Moreover, the integration of China, India, and Eastern Europe into the global economy has coincided with an information and communications revolution that, along with falling transport costs, has made it feasible to push the division of labor ever further. So it's not just the production of labor-intensive goods that has been shifting eastward, but also the labor-intensive elements within production cycles. So a product might be designed in an industrialized country, such as the United Kingdom, but assembled in a country, such as China, in turn using parts manufactured in surrounding countries. The geographical origin of a product becomes debatable in these circumstances. So made in China would often be more accurately rendered as assembled in China. Moreover, after-sales service might rely on a call center based in India to record problems, and then the company might utilize domestic workers to undertake repairs to rectify those problems. This unbundling of the production process into its constituent tasks and the reallocation of those tasks to places with a comparative advantage in undertaking them has increased the scope for businesses in the industrialized world to organize production in the most cost-effective manner possible. But this downward pressure on the wage of unskilled labor relative to that of skilled labor does not imply that unskilled labor in the industrialized economies is necessarily made worse off. The resulting exploitation of the gains from trade means that the developed economies have access to some goods and services more cheaply than they can be produced at home. If you like, it's similar to discovering a new and more efficient technology. So the purchasing power of unskilled workers' wages may rise, even though their wages relative to those of skilled labor may have fallen. And in fact, it's even possible that the demand for unskilled labor in the domestic economy could actually rise. That could happen if some domestic unskilled labor is still necessary in production, even after other tasks have been offshored, and if the decline in costs and fall in price stimulate a large enough increase in the demand for the product. So evaluating the ultimate impact of globalization on the living standards of unskilled workers in the industrialized economies is by no means straightforward. UK labor force survey data suggests that, for the UK at least, any adverse effect on the living standards of unskilled workers has been nugatory at best, as average gross weekly earnings for what you might call elementary workers actually grew at a slightly faster rate between 1995 and 2006 than those for all workers taken together. Though I guess I should mention that that may reflect in part the impact of the national minimum wage. Not everything has gone by the economics textbook, though. We would also have expected to see investment picking up in the emerging economies, with capital flowing from the industrialized economies, where it's abundant, to the emerging economies, where it's scarce. And if emerging economy households are able to borrow against their higher expected future income, we might also expect to see consumption picking up. So we should be observing a current account deficit in the emerging economies and a surplus on their capital accounts. Now, investment certainly has picked up. In China, it's touched an astonishing 45% of national output. But instead of running current account deficits, countries such as China have instead been running a surplus. So capital, far from flowing from the rich industrialized countries to the emerging economies, has tended to flow the other way, in particular to the United States. Okay, and that's illustrated in this chart, which gives you current account deficits on beneath the line, surpluses above the line. Back in 1997, the US was running a relatively small deficit, and you see counterpart surpluses, particularly in the euro area, Middle East and North Africa, and a few others. And a big change around as you go to 2006, with a very large US deficit. There's a few other countries, including the UK, which have which make a relatively small contribution to the sum of world deficits. And then the counterpart surpluses, particularly in developing Asia, so China is a good chunk of that. Also Japan, the solid green blob, and then Middle East and North Africa, which is mainly obviously OPEC oil producers as the light green. Those of you who are canny may have noticed that the sum of the deficits doesn't equal the sum of the surpluses. This reflects the difficulties of measuring these things, and collectively the world is actually running a current account deficit with Mars of something like $200 billion. So that reflects the fact that we don't know these things with any degree of accuracy, but the big picture is clearly one of the US running a big deficit and countries like China running a surplus. Okay, well, why might this have happened in contradiction to what the textbook tells us? Well, one explanation is that it reflects a deliberate policy choice. So the Asia crisis of 1997-98 revealed that developing countries relying on footloose foreign capital to finance investment were vulnerable to sudden stops or reversals in those capital flows. And that's made emerging economies more inclined to rely on domestic savings to finance their investment. In China's case, this has been partly through substantial saving by the official sector, and in particular by the accumulation of foreign reserves, particularly US treasuries, which are now approaching $1 trillion. Moreover, corporate saving has been unusually high in China, while the absence of a significant social safety net has also encouraged households to maintain high rates of saving in order to build up a store of wealth for precautionary purposes. A second explanation is that the capital markets in these countries are relatively underdeveloped, and that the institutions for intermediating funds from savers to investors are relatively inefficient. That means that they may be relatively less effective at utilizing capital inflows other than through foreign direct investment. That's when foreign companies invest directly in subsidiaries domiciled in the emerging economy or else via joint ventures. By contrast, the US financial markets are deep and liquid and still offer an attractive home for overseas investors. So that may be another force lying behind this chart. One other macroeconomic oddity that's also worth noting is the behavior of global real interest rates. Standard economic analysis would suggest that the increased demand for investment goods resulting from the increase in global labor supply ought to drive up the world real interest rate. But world real interest rates have in fact tended to fall over the past few years. And here you've got a chart of an estimate of UK real interest rates. These are actually forward real interest rates 5 years ahead. In the UK case, it's derived from the index gilt market. In the US and German cases, it uses estimates of nominal forward rates lesser measure of inflation expectations based from surveys. But they all basically give this same picture of declining world real interest rates over the past decade or so compared to what we saw in the preceding 10 or 20 years. Now, this decline in world real interest rates is something that former Fed chairman Alan Greenspan has described as a conundrum, and the current Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, has attributed it to an unusually high level of global savings, what he calls a savings glut, not just because much of the investment in the emerging economies has been financed by domestic savings, but also because of high rates of savings in Japan and the European Union, driven by the aging of their workforces. It's also possible that the rapid growth in global liquidity during the early years of the millennium may also have been part of a factor behind this picture. Well, let me now turn to the aspect of globalization that's of particular concern to central bankers, namely its impact on inflation. The past 15 years have seen inflation rates settle at low levels throughout the industrialized world, and that's shown here. The blue line is retail price inflation for the UK over the last 40-odd years. And the green swathe covers all of the other inflation rates for the industrialised countries. So you can see this general tendency for inflation rates to have picked up in the 70s, coming down through the 80s. And then throughout the industrialised world, relatively low inflation rates through the 90s and into the new millennium. Also, it's worth noting that many countries in the developing world, which had previously experienced high inflation, have also seen it falling. Well, if you ask the average businessman or woman why this is the case, he or she is almost certain to reply that it's down to cheap imports from the Far East and Eastern Europe. Monetary policy and the efforts of the Monetary Policy Committee won't get a mention, I can assure you. Yet you will all know from your first-year macroeconomics course, or at least you should know, that this can't be right, as inflation must ultimately be a monetary phenomenon. So how can we reconcile the businessman's view with the economist's? The answer, of course, is that globalization essentially represents a shock to relative prices, not the absolute price level. Imports are only one part of the consumption basket, and what happens to the general price level also depends on what happens to the prices of domestically produced goods and services. The prices of tradable goods that are close substitutes for the imports may be driven down, but the prices of other goods, and especially non-tradable services, can rise faster. This may happen automatically if consumers react to the rise in purchasing power associated with cheaper imports to increase their spending on other goods and services, driving up their prices. But even if it doesn't act this way, the overall inflation rate should in the long run remain unchanged, provided only that the monetary authorities ensure that steady growth in overall nominal demand is maintained through an appropriate monetary policy. If a country does not fix its exchange rate and is free to pursue an independent monetary policy, it can always ultimately choose its own inflation rate. This is graphically illustrated in chart 4, which shows the inflation rates of goods and services for the United Kingdom separately. For much of the past decade, goods price inflation was depressed by the increased availability of cheap imports, especially from Asia. So that's the sort of period, 1999-2000, round to 2005, when you can see the prices of goods was actually falling. If you go back in time before this chart begins, the general picture here is one of goods price inflation running a couple of percentage points or so below service price inflation, much as they are in 97-98, which just reflects the fact that productivity growth tends to be higher in manufacturing than in services. But you see this widening between services and goods price inflation as we go into 99-2000 and the ensuing years, which of course was the period when there was the peak offshoring activity of domestic production. Okay, but what you can see is that to a degree, this decline in the inflation rate of goods, was offset by relatively rapid inflation in the less internationally tradable services category. I might also draw your attention to the recent pickup of the rate of inflation in goods prices as the effect of the increase in energy prices since 2004 and buoyant global demand works through, together with the corresponding decline in services inflation. So that's the last couple of years of the chart. But I should stress this doesn't mean that globalization has been irrelevant for the inflation process in the industrialized economies. Recall first that the standard view, what you will have learnt in your first year macroeconomics course, suggests that inflation is related both to the level of demand relative to potential supply, what's sometimes referred to as the output gap, and also to expected inflation. Activity can only run ahead of potential supply in the economy so long as inflation runs ahead of expectations. Any attempt to systematically exploit this short-run trade-off is ultimately doomed to failure, as inflation expectations will eventually adjust. And this is an insight that won Ned Phelps this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. But globalization can affect this story in a number of ways. First of all, movements in the terms of trade, that's the price of exports relative to imports, associated with globalization, potentially alters the level of activity that's consistent with stable inflation. Thus, the availability of cheap imports from Asia has acted very much like a positive supply shock, boosting potential supply. That's because businesses' demand for labor depends inversely on the cost of that labor relative to the price of their output, while workers' supply of labor depends on the purchasing power of their earnings, some of which is spent on imported goods. So a fall in the price of imports relative to domestic goods allows workers to enjoy higher real wages without any cost to their employers. And this then tends to raise the equilibrium level of employment in the economy. In effect, then, the beneficial terms of trade shock from globalization provides a favorable tailwind, allowing central banks to run the economy at a higher level of activity than would otherwise have been the case, or else to bring inflation down without having to squeeze down on growth so much. But empirical studies, and many of these were carried out at the Center for Economic Performance here at LSE, suggest that this effect that I'm talking about from the terms of trade may only be temporary, possibly because workers start building into their wage aspirations the extra increase in living standards from the terms of trade gain. And so that suggests we certainly shouldn't count on it continuing. Moreover, the development of China and India has been something of a double-edged sword, as rapid Asian growth has been a major driver of the tripling of oil prices since early 2004, as well as pushing up on the prices of non-oil commodities substantially. Countries importing these commodities have therefore suffered an increase in the price of these imports that offsets to some degree the gain from access to low-cost goods. Even for a country like the United Kingdom, which is roughly self-sufficient in oil, the rise in the oil price will still initially redistribute income away from households and non-oil businesses and towards the oil companies and the government. And should workers resist the consequent decline in the purchasing power of their wages, the level of potential supply would be adversely affected. The second potential effect of globalization is on the short-run dynamics of the inflation process. One of the most notable developments of the past decade has been the apparent flattening of the short-run trade-off between inflation and activity. This is particularly obvious in the case of the UK. So this is the UK Phillips curve, inflation on the vertical axis, the unemployment rate on the horizontal axis. And you can see that the period in the 1990s up to the present, which is the black period, pretty flat. And a similar picture obtains for the US. Again, the black blobs here are the 90s to the present. Again, a rather flat picture. Now if I can get back to the UK one. Okay, as you can see, with the UK. The 70s were characterised by an almost vertical relationship in the United Kingdom, in which any attempt to hold unemployment below its natural rate resulted in rising inflation. In the 80s, the downward sloping relationship reappears as inflation was squeezed out of the system by the slack in the economy. And then, as I've already said, in the 90s, the relationship looks to have considerably flattened. Now, in theory, it's possible that this flat experience over the last 15 years or so just reflects the MPC's, and prior to that, the Chancellor's, extraordinarily precise management of aggregate demand, which has kept unemployment exactly in line with a falling natural rate. But while macroeconomic policy may have been rather better over this period, it defies belief that it was that much better. Instead, it looks as if the inflation process itself may have changed in some way. Now, part of the story probably is connected to the change in policy regime, though in a more subtle fashion. Inflation targeting appears to have kept inflation's expectations well anchored, and here's a measure of inflation expectations derived from financial markets comparing index debt with nominal debt. This measures expectations for the retail price index, not the CPI, which we're supposed to target. That's why it's running around about 3% rather than the 2% target we have. And there'll probably be a small risk premium in here. But the general picture is one of inflation expectations having come down somewhat when the bank was given independence in 1997 and been pretty stable since then. So inflation targeting has kept inflation expectations well anchored. Whereas in the past, going back to, say, the 70s, falling unemployment might have led to expectations of higher future inflation, adding to the upward pressures on current inflation. Moreover, businesses need to raise prices less frequently to keep up with inflation when its average rate is low, so that increases in demand are less likely to lead to an increase in the overall price level, at least in the short run. But the structural consequences of globalization also seem to have flattened the short-run trade-off between inflation and the domestic output gap through a variety of channels. First of all, we have the increased trade and specialization associated with globalization, reducing the response of inflation to the domestic output gap. And at the same time, it potentially makes it more sensitive to the balance between demand and supply in the rest of the world. And there's a recent study carried out at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel by Claudio Borio and Andy Filardo, which finds some empirical support for this proposition of a reduced responsiveness of inflation to domestic output gaps and increased responsiveness to world output gaps across a wide range of countries. Second, increased competition from labour-abundant economies may reduce the cyclical sensitivity of profit margins, as businesses have less scope to raise their prices when domestic demand increases. So assuming that marginal costs rise with output, that's the normal assumption, we would expect that the markup of price over marginal cost will tend to be squeezed more when demand rises and vice versa when it falls. And work carried out at the bank by a former Monetary Policy Committee member and a former member of the LSE, Steve Nicol, together with Nicoletta Bettini and Brian Jackson, finds empirical evidence supporting this proposition. Third, production costs may also become less sensitive to the state of the business cycle. The increased ease with which activities can be offshored to China, India, or Eastern Europe will make workers less inclined to push for higher wages when unemployment falls and stiffen the hand of employers in resisting such claims, so limiting the effect of higher activity on the marginal cost of labour. Moreover, there's an additional factor that's worth mentioning in the case of the United Kingdom in the shape of increased inward migration. Official migration estimates, and here I should emphasise that there's very, very considerable uncertainty over the true magnitude of the migratory flows, together with a reasonable assumption about migrants' labor force participation suggests that migration probably accounts for around two-thirds of the increase in the UK workforce since 1997. The size of this flow, particularly from the accession countries of Eastern Europe, reflects in part the substantial wage differentials between the United Kingdom and the migrants' home countries, but the magnitude of the flow is also likely to vary in line with the tightness of the UK labour market. And businesses are increasingly used to sourcing their workers from abroad, often through the use of specialised agencies. So if they are finding it difficult to get the additional workers they need, rather than bidding up wages to attract them from other firms, they may instead simply look to get them from abroad. The migration resulting from increased international mobility of labour therefore represents another force that weakens the link between activity and the cost of labour. These three factors, that's increased specialisation, the intensification of product market competition, and the impact of that intensified competition and migration on the behaviour of wages, should all work to flatten the short-run trade-off between inflation and domestic activity. But it's worth mentioning one consequence of globalisation that might work in the opposite direction. An increase in the competitive pressure in product markets will mean that the profits foregone by setting a price at the wrong, i.e. the non-optimal level, will be all the greater. And that would encourage businesses to revise their prices more frequently and will tend to steepen rather than flatten the trade-off. And that's in the opposite direction from the likely impact of moving to an environment of low inflation that I mentioned earlier. So by way of providing some evidence on this, we recently asked our regional agents, the bank has a network of 12 regional agencies, and the agents spend their time going around talking to local businesses. We have about 8,000 business contacts. They find out from the agents what's actually happening on the ground, feed it back to the committee, and it's a very important source of information for us. But we occasionally get them to carry out surveys of some of their contacts on issues that are particularly puzzling us. So this is one of those surveys. So we asked our regional agents to conduct a survey in order to see how the frequency of price changes had changed over the past decade. And this gives the results from one of the questions in that survey, broken down by sector. So respondents were asked whether they were changing prices at about the same frequency as 10 years ago, more frequently or less frequently. Now, the striking thing in this chart is the increased frequency of price changes in the retailing sector. You can ignore the second row down, which says other, because this comprises just a handful of rather odd firms that are difficult to classify. And the other striking feature is the decreased frequency of price changes in manufacturing. Now, as it's the latter sector that's probably most exposed to the effects of globalization, this suggests that any effect on the frequency of price change from that quarter has been limited. But the increase in the frequency of price changes in retailing probably does reflect the dramatic intensification of competition there, what you might refer to as the Tesco effect. The extent to which the flattening of the short-run inflation activity trade-off is down to globalization, and the extent to which it's associated with the change in the monetary regime, is ultimately an empirical matter. There are some cross-country empirical studies that suggest that it's indeed flatter in more open economies. And there are also studies that suggest that the change in the conduct of monetary policy over the last decade and a half has been important. So both factors are likely to have some role to play. Perhaps even more important, though, is the way globalization has affected the response of inflation to demand. Perhaps even more important than the way globalization has affected the response of inflation to demand is the way that it appears to have altered the response to cost shocks. Now, if you had told the MPC in early 2004 that oil prices would triple over the following 2 years, I think I can guarantee that we would have been pretty worried. We would have been expecting that these higher oil prices would have been feeding through into higher wages, driving up other prices, and so forth. Now, while the oil intensity of production is about half what it was in the 70s, so that means that one might expect rather less of an effect than we saw then, it is remarkable that we've actually seen virtually no so-called second-round effects on wages, with workers seeking to maintain the purchasing power of their earnings, and similarly very little in the way of second-round effects on the prices of other goods and services. And that I can demonstrate here with this chart on regular pay growth. You can see far from regular pay growth in the UK picking up over the last couple of years when oil prices have been rising so strongly, and for that matter, gas prices. Regular pay growth has actually eased somewhat. Now, since consumer price inflation has picked up during that time, the rate of growth of the purchasing power of wages, and that's what sometimes referred to as the real consumption wage, that's the blue line here, that's slowed and ensured that the real wage in terms of the price of UK output, what's often referred to as the real product wage, and that's the thing that's relevant for firms' demand for labour, that's grown more or less in line with trend productivity growth. Now, one reason why wage growth may have been so subdued is that unemployment has edged up since early 2005, but that appears not to be the whole story. Exactly the same heightened competitive pressures in product markets that appear to have contributed to the flattening of the inflation-activity trade-off may also have affected the way that businesses have responded to the increase in energy costs. Rather than immediately pass on in full such increases in higher prices, it appears that they may have instead looked to lower other costs, either by granting lower wage increases or putting downward pressure on the prices of intermediate inputs, or else by raising efficiency. And again, we got our regional agents to carry out a survey to illuminate this issue. They asked a sample of their business contacts how they've responded to the squeeze in profit margins occasioned by the rise in energy costs. And the survey suggested that relatively few businesses expected to be able to raise prices. So that's the third from the bottom, less than 10%. Instead, you see quite a large fraction, getting on for a quarter, expecting to increase productivity or reduce employment. A significant fraction, particularly in manufacturing, that felt they had no alternative but just to take it in lower profit margins. And also here, a significant fraction, around about 15% or so, that were going to seek to bear down on wages. Okay, the consequence of this is that far from seeing second-round effects on wages and other prices as energy costs have risen, if anything, they so far seem to have acted as a bit of a cushion. And that's illustrated in chart 12, which shows the contribution to inflation of the domestic non-energy component of consumer prices for each of the United Kingdom, United States, Euro area, and Canada since 1993, plotted against the contribution of energy and import prices, which we can treat as being largely exogenous to each region. And for clarity and to allow for different average overall inflation rates, the inflation components here are all presented as deviations from regional averages. Now, there's clear signs of an inverse correlation in all regions, though admittedly the relationship is far from perfect. But if this relationship continues to hold in the future, then we might expect the beneficial effect on inflation from the recent fall in oil prices to be partly offset by faster inflation in the non-energy components of consumer price inflation as businesses seek to rebuild their profit margins and workers make up for the squeeze on the purchasing power of their wages. Now, some commentators have interpreted this view as implying that a rise in oil prices is bad news and a fall in oil prices is also bad news. And that, of course, is nonsense. The presence of a countervailing response of non-energy price inflation to changes in energy price inflation just means that a rise in oil prices is not such bad news for inflation as it first appears, and the rise in, that a fall in oil prices is not such good news as it first appears. Finally, some brief words on how the changes in inflation dynamics that appear to be down in part to the impact of globalization might affect the conduct of monetary policy. Clearly, the reduced pass-through of energy cost increases into wages and prices is good news for central banks. But the flattening of the inflation activity trade-off is rather more of a mixed blessing. On the one hand, demand shocks and policy errors will not show up in large movements of inflation away from the target. On the other hand, variations in aggregate demand become rather less effective as a means of controlling inflation. So if inflation is settled above the target, a deeper or more prolonged slowdown is potentially required to bring it down. That puts an even greater premium on keeping inflation expectations well anchored around the target. Now, given that we know relatively little about how people form their expectations, it suggests that it's better to err on the side of caution by preventing any sustained pickup, or for that matter, decline, in inflation in the first place. And given that demand movements may contain little information about future inflation pressures, it suggests the need to pay particular attention to direct measures of incipient inflationary pressures in both product and labour markets. Well, let me conclude by noting that the integration of China and other emerging economies represents both an opportunity and a challenge for the industrialised economies. It's an opportunity because it allows a more efficient international division of labour and has the potential to raise living standards in both East and West. And it's a challenge because the global relocation of activities potentially involves losers as well as gainers. The danger is then that the realisation of those potential gains is prevented by the imposition of protectionist measures. And the challenge to policymakers is to try and make sure that doesn't happen. Globalisation also offers a special challenge to monetary policymakers. While globalisation is not the ultimate cause of the generally low and stable inflation experienced by most industrialised economies over the past 15 years, the associated improvement in the industrialised countries' terms of trade has provided a benign backdrop to the widespread pursuit of low inflation through stability-oriented monetary policies. But that beneficial tailwind has waned somewhat in the past couple of years. Moreover, intensified competition in product markets, along with other factors, does seem to have altered the way in which wages and prices are determined, complicating our task. Central bankers are a long way from having a full understanding of what's going on here, and further research on these questions is definitely called for. So perhaps when I next give a speech here, some of you will come up with the answers. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Charlie, for a very interesting talk. The way I see it, if I could summarize in one word in the language that we speak in lectures, is that globalization did not reduce inflation directly, but reduced the natural rate of unemployment. Yep. So shifted the Phillips curve both to the left and made it flatter. So it made their job on the Monetary Policy Committee easier, I guess. We could take some questions. I mean, Charlie has kindly offered to stay on for 20 minutes or so for questions. So anyway, and I should say actually before that, there's a note here that this speech is being recorded and will be broadcast through the LSE website in something called the podcast, which I have no idea what it means, but that's what this piece of paper here says. I guess if you go to the LSE website, you'll find it, but maybe not for a few days from what I see. So any questions, please? Yeah, let's start with Sushil here.
I guess I have two questions, I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit more on essentially the link between globalization and the Nairu.
Okay. Well, it might have been switched on, is it? Give it a tap.
Sorry. I wondered if you could elaborate a bit more on the linkage between globalization and the Nairu. You certainly alluded to the Standard Channel through terms of trade effects, but you sounded a bit skeptical about that, in part because of the work at the CEP. I wondered if the effect of product market competition wasn't just on flattening the curve, but was also on affecting the Nairu, and you know, would love to hear more about your views on that. And the second thing was I was very pleased to hear what you said about the linkage between oil prices and inflation, that you know, when oil prices fall, some commentators might have misinterpreted the bank in terms of thinking that's bad news as well. But on that particular issue, I wondered if you could comment on whether a part of the reason commentators have said what they've said is the communication that's emanated from the bank. In the sense, when oil prices were going up, there was a lot of rhetoric from the bank about how that was potentially bad news. But when oil prices have fallen, there's certainly been a tendency in some speeches to poo-poo it as being kind of relevant to inflation.
Okay. As regards the first of those issues, the terms of trade, the Nairu and all of that, I mean, you described me as being a bit sceptical about the effect. It's not so much I'm sceptical, but there's a question about how durable it is. And I don't think that we should take for granted that any beneficial effect from the terms of trade onto the natural rate of unemployment will necessarily persist for a long time. And that is founded, basically, on the empirical work to which you've contributed. You do, however, raise, I think, what is a valid point, which I didn't mention, but is certainly potentially relevant, which is that increased competition in product markets may have effects both on the natural rate of unemployment, insofar as it affects the outcome of wage bargaining implicitly. It may end up weakening the hand of workers if firms can't pass a wage increase on. And then that strengthens their hand in a bargain. But also, of course, in the product market itself, to the extent that markets become more competitive, standard microeconomic thinking tells you that that will, at the end of the day, lead to an expansion in supply if markets are more competitive. So there may be effects on potential output coming from competition through both of those channels. And I mean, you're right, I didn't mention them, but they certainly may be there. On the second issue of oil prices and whether it's good news or bad news when they go down, you may well be right that our communication there could have been better. I don't think anything that we've actually said contradicts the what I said today, but clearly one or two commentators did pick up the idea that we thought the rise in oil prices was bad and we thought a fall in oil prices was bad as well, whereas the correct characterization would be that there's an attenuation of the oil price effect coming from what happens to the non-oil components of inflation.
Start from there. If you could signal to me, actually, if you want to ask a question, so I could direct the microphone to you. And
hi. I'd like just to look at the negative section of that graph that you've got on up on behind you. If you just look at the fall in energy import inflation, that section alone, it seems to have a slightly more steeper set of kind of correlations going on than certainly on the positive side for the UK especially. If you just look at the latest...
Well, I think it's also a bit non-linear.
Yes, certainly idea. More, and certainly perhaps a steeper slope. If you look at the latest CPI estimate that came for September, you saw a kind of 0.3 fall in the oil component, mainly due to petrol and transport costs. But you actually saw a lot of the other non-energy inflation and components more than offset it, so that we only got a very small fall. And if you see that there's a lag between energy prices which come through fairly quickly and non-energy components which are perhaps more lagging, wouldn't that suggest to you that over the next coming quarter or so that there is actually quite a risk that your past energy falls will actually more than offset the non-energy components, so you'll get actually CPI heading up quite sharply?
Well, I mean, what I would certainly say about this, this is a pretty crude scatter plot of just annual inflation rates. And really, to get into this issue properly, you need to dig down into the model of dynamics of the various components of the consumption basket and how it interacts. I mean, one of the key points here is that you shouldn't take what's happening to, say, the non-oil component of inflation as just exogenous and tracking along, doing its own thing independently of what's happening to oil prices. There's an interrelationship to them. This is a general equilibrium system. What I think is the case is that we don't fully understand the interaction between those two elements, the energy and the non-energy components. Now, it looks like the world is different from what it used to be 20, 30 years, but we're still quite a long way from understanding exactly the nature of that dynamic relationship, how much of the forces that I've been talking about operate through demand, how much through supply, exactly which bits of supply, the various channels that I talked about today. So.
There was a question there at the back end.
Hi, can you just, going back to the domestic industry, can you elaborate something about the housing market in terms of its contribution to the economic growth in the UK? Also, can you talk about the importance of the financial services industry in terms of its contribution to the competitiveness of the UK? And what do you think is its long-term prospects of development? Thank you very much.
Okay, well, let's take the second of those first, financial services. That you could regard as the classic knowledge-based industry that the UK would have a comparative advantage in the world that we've moved to with an increase in the relative in the supply of unskilled labour and labour-intensive production shifting off to the east, whether to Eastern Europe, China, wherever. The areas that you would expect the UK to have a comparative advantage in will be knowledge, what I refer to as knowledge-based industry, and I would include the financial services sector within that. Now, you can argue with something like financial services, there's all sorts of special factors. One of the reasons why the City of London thrives is because people know that there's a pool of financially qualified labour all around. So that's why firms come in there. That attracts more of that sort of labour into the city. So you sort of get what economists refer to as an agglomeration externality. That means it's quite difficult to disturb a location like that, which has got ahead once it started. So that's one of the reasons, I think, for being optimistic about the future of the City of London. And, you know, it will be an important part of where our comparative advantage lies in the future. Not the only part, but a significant part. Now, I've forgotten what your first question was again. The housing market. I mean, this is a bit distinct from the topic of the lecture, obviously. I mean, it is an issue where different people take different views how important the housing market is to consumer spending and the economy more generally. I mean, as you're probably aware, certainly if you've gone out to try and buy a house, house prices now are considerably higher relative to earnings than they were 10 years ago.
Now, one of the questions is why has that happened and is it sustainable? And we've spent a lot of time, just like outsiders, in trying to get to the bottom of that. There's good reasons why house prices might be higher. The demand for housing has been rising rapidly because of the expansion in the population, because of people wanting second homes, all those sorts of things. The supply of new homes hasn't been keeping up with that. The transition to a low interest rate, low inflation world makes mortgages more affordable in the early years for people, and that makes them willing to take out bigger mortgages. So there's a clutch of reasons why you might think the sustainable house price to earnings ratio is higher now than it was in the past. Exactly how much higher, it's very difficult to say. In terms of its links with consumer spending, our view is that you shouldn't think primarily of housing as being like conventional wealth. It's not like holding equity shares or something like that. Because if the price of my house goes up, if I want to live in that standard accommodation, I can sell my existing house and get more for it. But to buy an equivalent house, I'd equally have to pay more. So a rise in house prices doesn't make me any better off. It's only if I anticipate trading down, as might be the case, you know, towards the end of the life cycle, that a rise in house prices would have made me better off. But what a rise in house prices does do is potentially allow households to borrow against that collateral. And we think that's probably the primary channel whereby changes in house prices can affect consumption. But how important that collateral link may be, it's going to be something that varies over time depending on how much consumers want to borrow, how much spare collateral there is, and so forth. So it's quite a subtle nexus.
There's a question in the front row here.
Hi. I have two questions. The first question is more based on your presentation, I think. You talked about yourself that inflation is a monetary phenomenon, as Friedman said. Is there any way we could maybe say that stabilization could be a threat to that thesis or that hypothesis, but somehow the conduct of monetary policy in the future might not be the same as today because of globalization? That's the first question. The second question is, it's more to, I'm not sure if I get the order right, but I think the Bank of England changed their targeting, I think it's RPI instead of CPI. If you could elaborate a bit on that, and whether that's got anything to do with the dynamics of the inflation rates or globalization.
Right. Okay, on the first of those, I'm not sure I necessarily quite understood what you were driving at. What certainly appears to be true is that the nature of the inflation process has changed, and that means how we think about the economy necessarily has to be different. In the old days, when you had a reasonably upward sloping short run inflation activity trade-off, it would be relatively easy to spot when you'd push the economy higher than potential supply, because you'd see inflation picking up. What appears to be the case now is that those price signals are much less strong, so we can't really rely on that sort of information to tell us, are we operating above or below potential? There's other indicators that we can look at, but you know, they're imprecise. Now, you might say, well, does that really matter if the trade-off is pretty flat? It wouldn't really matter if you run the economy in excess of its potential for a while. But the danger is that at some stage, that starts feeding through to inflation because you are running the economy at an excessive rate. Or it may start leading to downward pressure on the exchange rate and push through inflation pressures that way. So the inflation pressures come about in a different sort of way, potentially. And the sort of indicators that we've often looked at in the past for diagnosing inflationary pressures may be a bit less reliable than they were in the past. So our task becomes easier in some ways, but more difficult in others. The second question on the switch of target, well, this was something that was mandated by the Chancellor. Initially, we used to target the retail price index, excluding mortgage interest payments, and the target was an inflation rate of 2.5% for that. And about, I guess it's a couple of years ago, it was switched to 2% for the consumer price index. Now, the reason for that switch was that at the time the Chancellor wanted to introduce it as part of his moving in the direction of being able to enter the euro, because the CPI is the same sort of index as the European Central Bank uses. And the difference between the inflation rate of CPI and RPIX is somewhere between, this is on average, between about half and three quarters. The reason for that is partly because of the technicalities of the way it's structured, partly because RPIX includes a housing cost element and a number of other technical issues.
Six questions here. How many do you want to take? All six, quickly?
I don't mind, yes.
Okay, there's a question at the right there.
I work for the International Simultaneous Policy Organization, which is a voting strategy to drive governments around the world to cooperate with each other to be able to implement policies simultaneously, which no government can implement unilaterally, because it would leave it at a competitive disadvantage to attracting foreign investment for jobs. One of the policies which people around the world who support simultaneous policy put forward is monetary reform, whereby governments, rather than private banking institutions, introduce money into the system debt-free, therefore relieving the taxpayer in Britain $50 billion a year from paying interest on the privilege of the use of private bankers' money, which they introduce into the system and print out of thin air. Do you think monetary reform, obviously you've heard of monetary reform, which was the idea of Major Hugh Clifford Douglas in the beginning of last century, and also from, President Lincoln said that said governments rather than private banking institutions should issue money into the system debt-free, therefore relieving the taxpayer the enormous debt burden, making money the tool of mankind instead of mankind the slave of it. So do you think monetary reform, i.e. governments introducing money into the system debt-free rather than banking institutions, could solve global problem? Because we have a debt hole that can never be filled, and we have to produce more and more goods to the detriment of society and the ecology to produce goods to fill a debt hole that can never be filled, because we always introduce money into the system as debt. What's your...
Well, the first thing I would say is, I don't take a censorious view of debt. I mean, debt is a way of whether it be consumers, companies, governments, transferring spending across time. I mean, if my income is temporarily reduced because I'm unemployed, it's obviously sensible for me to borrow to keep my consumption up and then pay it back when I get into work. Similarly, it's sensible for governments to borrow when times are temporarily tough, when, you know, say if there's an earthquake, or the classic time for governments to borrow is during wars and pay them back in peace. So I don't think it's right to take a view that we should somehow or other get rid of all debt in the system. And of course, as far as money goes, I mean, the government in the form of the central bank is the sole originator of high-powered money. The monetary base for the economy, notes and coin, and the reserves on which the banking system is based.
That's 3%
of our money. Yes, it is. But when you say it's debt, I mean it. What certainly may well be true is that the actions of banks and other financial intermediaries certainly has an impact on the macroeconomy and on inflation. One of the things that the MPC spends a lot of time studying is exactly what banks are doing. But I don't think the solution is to try and get rid of them altogether. As financial intermediaries, I think they play a pretty key role in keeping the wheels of commerce going. But maybe you and I should talk about this afterwards and let somebody
question
else
here in the front.
Professor Bean, may I say as an ex-student of yours, how refreshing
yes,
it was
I remember you.
To
yeah.
finally receive a lecture from you without any matrix algebra in it. but my question really relates to a key part of your talk where I found the omission of any mention of exchange rates to be a little bit surprising given the nature of the subject that you were referring to. And one of the most interesting charts that you put up was that one which showed the external imbalances between the US and particularly Asia and its counterpart. Now, you know, you could put forward a thesis which would suggest that you could sustain a world of low inflation even if one part of the world is growing at where demand is growing faster than domestic supply, so long as there's a spare capacity gap at the global level, but that can only go so far, and eventually you'd expect exchange rates to kick in and adjust, and certainly in the case of the dollar, it collapsed in the dollar. But you know, there has been a sort of common sort of consensus in the markets that part of the reason why this has not happened is because these massive export earnings that the Asians have been making have been recycled back to support the dollar and hold up the dollar exchange rate, and I guess prevent any significant appreciation of Asian exchange rates. Do you hold with that thesis, firstly? And secondly, if you do, what do you think might cause the Asians to actually change that policy at some stage?
Well, it's part of the story. I think it's probably not all of the story, and it was that I was alluding to when I was talking about the accumulation of official reserves by the Chinese getting up to $1 trillion and so forth. Now, what is probably true is that a correction of the pattern of global imbalances, the US current account deficit and the counterpart surpluses elsewhere in the world, when that happens, you would certainly expect to see a change in the real exchange rate of the dollar. That's not to say that a change in the real exchange rate is the solution. What you need to change current account imbalances is for the US to save more, spend less, and the reverse in the rest of the world. And then as the counterpart to that, those changes in savings investment balances in different parts of the globe, you would expect to see the real exchange rate change. And there, of course, there's been quite a lot of analysis of the sort of adjustment that might be needed. Obsfeld and Rogoff and similar authors have suggested that probably a substantial decline in the real value of the dollar will be needed at some time as part of the rebalancing process. But having said that, it's very difficult to know exactly what the process whereby we get from here to there will be, whether this will be a smooth adjustment. And if you think back to what happened in the latter part of the 80s and the current account imbalances that we had there, which gradually unwound through the second half of the 80s, and that was accompanied by a substantial decline in the dollar, but it was all accompanied really relatively smoothly. And that may happen again. To the extent that some of the forces which are driving the pattern of current account imbalances that we see are associated with the lack of developed financial markets in some of the developing countries, the emerging countries. That suggests it might be something that takes quite a long time to play out. The worry, of course, has to be that adjustment gets triggered by the financial markets and asset prices and the exchange rate in particular moves ahead of the required adjustments. And in that case, the evolution could be a very bumpy and awkward one. Now, we would have to manage it when it happens along with the other central banks, but there's a variety of scenarios that that you can see going forward.
I think we should take just one more question. I'm afraid that it's a little demand, but we should let you go.
He used to work for me, so...
He's the last question. Yes.
Okay, so, thanks. The UK is often characterised as a pure inflation targeting regime because the bank's remit doesn't say anything about explicitly about output. Now, in the past, the government has argued that that's not right. You know, the MPC aren't inflation nutters, not least because the remit doesn't say how quickly inflation needs to be brought back to target after a shock. And so it gives the MPC a certain amount of flexibility in considering output volatility as well. But from what you've just said, you talked about the great uncertainties that globalisation brings in terms of assessing the inflation situation, and also the loss of credibility, the cost of that, mean that the committee should err on the side of caution. Are you saying essentially that in the current environment, the MPC do need to be inflation nutters, that they do need to try and keep inflation as close to target as possible at all points in time, and therefore that monetary policy needs to be pretty aggressive?
I don't think I would necessarily be going quite that far, but it clearly, if you've got relatively small deviations from target, which look as if they're temporary, you know, we wouldn't be worried about them. It's when there's events that have come along which look as if they might more durably push you away from target that you might be a bit more worried. Now, that's something that you would want to be working against anyway, but to the extent that there is any risk that inflation expectations might get dislodged as well, the costs of that happening are all the greater in the world that I've sketched out here, with a relatively flat flat trade-off that potentially you'd have to have in due course a more prolonged or deeper slowdown to get inflation back down. I don't think this is quite the same as saying that we're inflation nutters, but it's partly that there's other things that we need to focus on in making our assessment and judgment each month. It's not really just a case of looking at what's happening to demand relative to our estimate of supply. Things other than output gaps are important. Inflation expectations, insofar as that we can measure them, are obviously a key variable.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid time is running on, so we can't take any more questions. It remains for me to thank Charlie, Professor Bean, for the lecture. You can see from the number of questions that there's a lot of interest, and also thank the Economic Society for arranging the events, LSE for staging the event. Thank you very much. Yeah.